Hello and welcome to a responsive day for the first day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev. Let's thank Rabbi Jacob Bromwitz, David Hachazer, and the OU for making these shiurim available online. This in particular is a day we have to thank David Hachazer because he is the one who noticed that we had not, that I had forgotten or not noticed that I had not recorded a responsive for the first day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev, which is a relatively rare day in Jewish history. My quick count showed that it's about 10 every 19 years, which is more than other bet, right? Other bet happens less often than that, but is not as frequent as other days for sure. So for today's discussions, we have to thank David Hachazer for noticing that, because without him, we would have forgotten to have this year, and you would not have the opportunity to learn from Rabbi Chaim Berlin. Rabbi Chaim Berlin, by the time you're listening to this, you hopefully, I hope, have listened to many other shiurim. We periodically come across Rabbi Chaim Berlin. His Shut Nishmat Chaim, responsive number 169, is from the first day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev of 1897. It's a second response. We're not going to have time to go through the whole first response. It's the second response, but a case where we're not told the actual case. And I don't think I actually found the first response on the issue, but from the discussion in this responsum, it seems that a man had made a gift to one of his children prior to his death. He gave that, you know, he's living, whatever, he gives a kid $1 million, let's pretend. By doing so, in that, he'd given that one child a lot more than the other children. So that means to avoid, meaning in halacha, theoretically, when a person passes away, all of the heirs should divide it equally. By giving this prior gift before he went, he had disadvantaged the other children, and they, it seems like, wanted to know if that was a valid gift. So the person writing to Rav Chaim Berlin agreed with the other children. He based that on a paragraph in Choshen Mishpat, chapter 99, paragraph 6, which says that if someone makes a gift directly clearly directed at avoiding repayment of a loan. So, for example, let's suppose that I owe somebody money and they're going to come collect it. I don't have any cash, but I have assets. But I don't want them to get the assets, and these assets have a lien on them. So what I do is I find a way to unload those assets. Now, if they were landed assets, they would have a lien even if I gave them as gift to somebody else or even if I sold them to somebody else. But we're talking about movable assets. So those, once they're no longer in my possession, the creditor is not able to collect on them. So let's say I don't want to pay taxes or medical bills in America today, so you can try to get rid of all your assets and then Medicaid can't come after you or whatever it is, and the government will pay for it. So just as that's wrong to do in the American context, because that's not the way the law works, that's the way the Medicaid fund is supposed to be, that you know, when they say they'll pay for those who have no assets, who have no way to pay their own, so you just give away the money as a symbolic, not a symbolic thing, but as a way around it, that's not supposed to work. And so too in halacha, the Choshen Mishpat paragraph is saying that if a lender can demonstrate that the gift that was given, or the way that this gift was given purely to take those assets off the book of the creditor, of the guy who owes the money, of the debtor, not the creditor, of the debtor, of the guy who owes the money, the creditor, the lender, can take repayment from that gift, can go and collect that gift, even though ordinarily movable property doesn't have what's called a lien on it, meaning movable property, if I sell it or give it away to somebody, normally any creditors I may have can't go after them because it's no longer in my possession, and there's no shiabud, there's no lasting connection of that property to this loan. The Ramah comments on that paragraph that that's an issue that's a matter of judgment of the court, meaning there's no standard for how you prove that a gift was given to avoid having to pay back a loan. If the gift seems to them to have been out of an honest desire to give a gift, even though it has the secondary function of losing out this creditor, so the Ramah seems to think that that's fine. So these sources make it like it's a judgment call, and it was how to judge that, which Rabbi Berlin now is going to disagree with about the guy who's writing in this thing. In their previous correspondence, Rabbi Berlin, the Nishmat Chaim, Rabbi Chaim Berlin, had apparently pointed out, never said anything about this, meaning he never made any reference to it. It could be, theoretically, the other guy could say, well, he's just smart enough not to. But the deceased father never said something like, there's no record of him, he said something like, I really want you to have more than your brothers and sisters, or just brothers in those days, and therefore I'm giving you this now. Or, let me get ahead of the curve on the inheritance, I'll give you this now. He never mentioned anything like that. So Chaim Berlin had said that you want to count a gift as havracha, as an attempt to elude a debt. That's the case in the Shulchan Aruch. To avoid paying a debt, You need something that lets us know it. It's not just a pure judgment call. I mean, this other rabbi, Rishon Lakish, says it's a judgment call. Judgment call, he thinks, means that just the judges think that it's true. But Rabbi Chaim Berlin thinks that no, for it to come to the Zavrachah, there has to be some kind of an explicit recognition of something. It doesn't have to be direct. It doesn't have to be as heavy-handed as, oh no, the taxpayers are coming, let me give you this to avoid it. Or in our case, it doesn't have to be anything as heavy-handed as, oh no, I don't want those brothers inheriting as much as you, here I'll give you a gift. But it has to be something. There has to be some explicit indication by the father that this is the underlying motive, or inferential indication, but not just the pure fact of the gift. Just the fact that a father who is, 99 years old and has $1.5 million in assets and gives $1 million of them to a son one day as he hits his 99th year, that in and of itself, Rabbi Chaim Berlin says, is not an obvious attempt to lehavriach, to avoid the usual way that inheritance is supposed to go. Now, the man writing the letter, the correspondent, suggested, well, fathers don't always say everything that's important, and there can be an unstated agenda of a gift, but that doesn't make it no less of an agenda. Meaning, just because the father didn't say anything doesn't mean it didn't happen, doesn't mean that wasn't the intent. That's the other guy, Rabbi Chaim Berlin points out, that in Chosh Mishpat, elsewhere in Chosh Mishpat, chapter 61, paragraph 9, the Shulchan Aruch says specifically that we cannot and don't invalidate gifts or deeds or sales on the basis of assumptions. We always need better proof. So that's the issue here. We don't have proof of it. So Chaim Berlin is saying, even when the Shulchan Aruch says X is a judgment call can't be out of the air. A judgment call has to have some basis and some evidence that will then lead to it. So if the father said nothing other than, what a nice boy you are, or, you've come to visit me the last 100 days in a row, I really appreciate that, here's $100,000. Whatever the answer is, but if he says nothing about inheritance and avoiding it, Chaim Berlin is not convinced. So the correspondent tried another source. The Gemara Bava Batra on Ayin Amud Bet talks about the fact that if a person doesn't mention a debt, we're allowed to take it as an indication that you're not in a pace. This comes up in things like, let's say, after somebody's death, a creditor comes to the orphan, so collecting more of the doors is a challenge or a problem, but one of the questions will be, the orphan said, we don't even know if there was such a debt, or maybe our father paid it back. So the Gemara there suggests that if the father never mentioned the debt on his deathbed as he was going through his affairs and sort of trying to give his kids some sense of what was going on in his financial life, that the fact that he didn't mention it at all, you might have thought the fact that he didn't mention it at all means that there is no such debt. But the Gemara there says no. The fact that he doesn't mention it means he hasn't paid it yet. But Rabbi Chaim Berlin points out that that's not the opinion we accept there. The opinion we accept there is that sometimes when people are at the end of their life trying to sum up everything they have, and this is a reminder that it would be better if people, it's hard to think to do, but it would be better if people settle their affairs or at least give their children a sense of their affairs. Sometimes before you know, sadly, there are people who pass away at young ages and suddenly. So they don't have time to put their affairs in order. But there are people who have long illnesses that are at least reasonably likely going to lead to their passing from the world. Or there are people who reach ages. When somebody reaches 85, you'd think by then it would be a time to sit down with whoever the heirs are going to be and give them a sense of what the financial arrangements are. But if they didn't do that, Rabbi Chaim Berlin says that's what the Gemara is talking about. That when there's somebody who is in rushing, and the angel of death is out there already for this person, they're rushing to give their kids a sense of their financial information, they can leave out stuff and not get around to mentioning it just because they forget to, so that therefore their silence on the issue of debts doesn't tell us anything about whether or not they had paid that debt. We can't always assume that just because people do or don't say something on their deathbed that we can pick up on what's going on. So that would again say that the fact that the father doesn't say a particular thing doesn't tell us anything, and the fact the father doesn't, so right, so unless the father says something, we're not allowed to draw inferences, is the point, right? The correspondent wanted to draw the inference, show you that the Gemara says silence can be an inference. So here too, he would say, even with silence, we can know that it's about this. Chaim says, no, the truth is that we don't say that in the Gemara over there, because we don't know what the inference of silence could be. The inference of silence could be you already paid back the debt, or it could be you just didn't get around to talking about it. Here too, the gift could be because he's trying to avoid inheritance, or the gift could be because of some other reason he didn't get around to mentioning. So therefore, Rav Chaim Berlin continues to believe that silence will not help us in this situation, and therefore we cannot cast aspersions on this gift and see it as a way to avoid sharing the inheritance with the other brothers. And once it's no longer a way to avoid, then we have no reason to invalidate it or to compare it to those loan avoidance gifts that we invalidate. Pirkei Tshuva Choshen Mishpat 99.7 quotes a Chavos Yair, right? The Tshuva, the response of the Chavos Yair, who invalidated a gift a man had made to his daughter. So, and without saying anything, but in that case, a man, a widower, had married a second wife. Before he married the second wife, he wrote a document to his daughter, and now he didn't just give her a gift. What he did was he certified a loan that would come due an hour before his death, meaning it's collectible before the second wife's ketubah became payable, right? So, that's to say, in other words, part of what you have going on there is I think that this man marries a second wife, but he doesn't want to leave his daughter from the first marriage destitute. He's trying to figure out a way. Now, he could have theoretically just given it to her as a gift in his lifetime. I think he didn't want to do that. One of the reasons is that people don't always have enough money that they can give gifts in their lifetime, but he has to live off of it. But once he's going to be dying, he won't need it anymore. In this particular instance, the case at hand was also that it was going to get the daughter make her be able to, or give her the ability to take possession of the family house, meaning, let's say the girl grew up in a certain house, and they're going to keep that house in the family. He marries a second wife. If the second wife's ketubah comes into effect, she's going to take the house. The husband doesn't want her to take the house. The husband thinks that he'll do whatever he'll do by her, or he'll do right by her, whatever he'll do right by her, but the house should go to the daughter. Chavos Yair ruled that that was clearly an attempt to avoid the second wife getting the house in her ketubah payment. Right? That's what it, now the loan never mentioned it. He just wrote out a document saying, I owe my daughter, you know, $100,000, and this loan is payable an hour before my death. So an hour before my death is important because you make it payable after you die. Once a man passes away, the wife's ketubah goes into effect immediately. So that won't help him. So it's got to be before he passes away. The ketubah is not yet in effect. She therefore can get the house, but he never says it so she can get the house. The Chavos Yair says, even though he never said it, it's clearly an attempt to avoid it. Now, had the loan possibly come due during the life of father's lifetime, and he didn't, it was the fact that he timed it to an hour before his passing. So an hour before his passing means he doesn't want to ever have to deal with this in his lifetime. Now, what he could have done was written out the loan document and had it come due in 20 years. Now, even if he was 80 at the time, but 20 years is possibly within his lifespan. So even though we could say it's still the same thing, it's just that he made it due for 20 years so that he wouldn't have to really pay it in his lifetime. And also, he trusted his daughter that if it came due, she in fact wouldn't collect and displace him. But then the Chavos Yair says we could have seen it as a real debt. Why? Because the construction of the loan, the terminology of the loan, the phrasing of the loan did not say anything that would make clear that it was about forestalling the actions of this second wife. But when he makes it about his death, so then its only purpose clearly is to cheat the widow. And so the Chavos Yair saw that as an example of blatantly circumnavigating a debt and invalidating it. So now the correspondent is raising that because he's saying, well, so if this gift is given too close to the father's passing, even if he's not yet ill, you know, deathly ill, he's close to the passing, he's giving the gift, doesn't that count as an attempt to circumvent? And we've just said, once we can be sure that it's an attempt to circumvent, then the Beit Din can invalidate the gift and make it go back. So Chaim Berlin points out, though, that the guy left out part of the conversation because later authorities, the Urim V'Tumim, wrote that we should be very careful about when we invalidate documents. If we have a validated document, we need to have significant proof. True, the Chavos Yair thought that that case was enough proof, but don't extrapolate easily from there. So in the case under discussion with Chaim Berlin here, we don't have any specific reason to think there's Havracha. Right, the attempt to avoid paying a debt. There's no debt yet, right? At most, he's favoring one child over the others, which fathers in their lifetimes are allowed to do. Meaning, if this gift had happened 10 years earlier, when the father was younger and in better health, nobody could have questioned it because it wasn't in any way connected to the possible passing. It's only that he's now old and maybe infirm. They're saying, see, he's trying to avoid the other son's inheriting with their brother. Not only that, even if there were evidence that the son pressured the father into giving him an extra gift, giving him more than the other brothers were going to get, Rabbi Chaim Berlin says, that Esav did the same thing to Yitzchak, And he got a blessing out of it, that whenever the Jews don't behave, Esav will rule over them. And that's caused us, you know, trouble throughout the years. Because whenever we don't do what we're supposed to do, there's Esav out there ready to take us over. But the point is that the Torah doesn't say anything negative about Esav's actions there. So it seems to be that the actions of his son, asking or begging or imploring or pleading or pressuring the father to give him more than the other brothers get, might not be the best characteristic and the character trait in the world, but it doesn't give us any reason to think that it's inherently wrong. Now I realize I said this thing a little too gently a second ago, because Rav Chaim Berlin notes that the guy writing to him, it said, well, the Tumim didn't specifically reject the Chavat Yair. So in other words, we could accept the Chavat Yair's idea. So I tried to find a way to say, Tumim was saying, even accept the Chavat Yair for that case. But then Chaim Berlin points out that the man writing the letter either hadn't seen the Tumim inside, or, and this is the phrase that he says, had made himself as if he hadn't seen. Now that's an insult, right? That's saying you're trying to pretend that you don't know what you know, but if you just looked at it, even if you looked at it reasonably, you would have known. Tumim, in fact, explicitly rejects the Chavos Yair. So once the Tumim, the Urim Tumim is an important Acharon, once he rejects the Chavos Yair, so who's an Acharon, who's a later authority, so then the Rav Chaim Berlin could say, you're right, the Chavos Yair would have agreed with you, but I don't think we follow the Chavos Yair, because later authority came along and said, we don't follow that opinion, and I'm going to follow that view, that later view. Now, what you do need to do, that says Rav Chaim Berlin, is to check for forgery. Right? If there's a deed of gift to this son, you have to make sure that it's authentic. As Shulchan Aruch writes in other kinds of cases like this, that in all cases where somebody's getting something that wouldn't theoretically have belonged to them, and there's a deed saying that they do, attesting to that fact, it's the responsibility of the judge to be aware that, sadly, sometimes people try to forge such things. Maybe the father never gave such a gift, but this son wants the gift, so he forged something in his father's name. So the judge has to be alert to that possibility, to investigate it thoroughly enough to avoid fraud. But if after that checking, the document seems like it's a valid document, and the father's signature seems to be the signature that's on this document, then it's valid, and the gift stands. Now, that also makes the beneficiary of the gift into a muchzak, the one halakhically in possession of those items. Now, the reason why that's important is that when we're, let's suppose the other brothers bring a case about this, and they offer certain kinds of proof that they think that it means, that they think show that this brother should not be getting these possessions, whatever they are. Once we say that this person becomes the muchzak, he is the one halakhically in possession of those items. Now, that doesn't mean they belong to him, right? There could be lots of people who are, you know, I could walk up to random Jew X in the world who's got, you know, X item, he's got a, you know, my a Fabergé egg. And I say, that's not your Fabergé egg, that's my Fabergé egg. I might be right. Although I will admit I never owned a Fabergé egg, but I might be right. But before I could be right that halacha would care about, I'd have to prove it. And that's the standard of Hamotzi Mechavero Alav Haraya, that I have a higher obligation of proof when somebody else is in halachic possession of something, not halachic ownership, halachic possession of something. I have a higher standard of proof. Once we say that the deed of gift here by the father to the son has not had an element in it of obviously trying to avoid the giving of the inheritance to them, it's not a havraka, it's not an avoidance of paying a debt, and we verify that the deed of gift is not a forgery, so it's not that this brother has managed to forge a deed of gift, then he becomes a muchzak. Now again, there may be conditions where the brothers could prove that he did not deserve this, or in some way shouldn't belong to him, they should be able to have it, but that's going to be a higher level of proof. And for one example of that is, we don't usually say a migo lehotzi. So a migo, let's recall, is where I'm going to make a claim. And the claim that I'm going to make, that I make, has greater believability, because had I wanted to lie, I had an even better lie to say. So that comes up in halacha. Theoretically, if somebody was, you know, really clever, they would think of the better lie, they'd give the lower lie, because the better lie would have only been a, you know, a half claim. People wouldn't have completely believed it. Anyway, it can get complicated. But amigo is, I could have said X and been fully believed, is really the way it goes. Therefore, if I'm saying Y, which is a more problematic claim in terms of believability, but if I was going to lie, I would have said the better lie. So why would I say this lie if it wasn't true? So that's amigo. So amigo adds to the believability of a claim of mine by virtue of the fact that I had a much better lie out there. So we say amigo in lots of cases in halacha, but we don't say amigo lehotzi. So amigo lehotzi would mean I'll make a claim which would lead, you know, you to have to give me money, right, to take something out of your halachic possession. and I say the claim is clearly true because if I wanted to lie, I have this much better lie. So the halacha is we don't say amigo lahotzi. So once we've defined this son now, based on this deed of gift, as the muchzak, as the person in halachic possession of these items, then we can no longer say amigo lahotzi. Amigo, which is said when there's no motzi, when nobody is yet in possession of it. Let's say it's just material that's up for grabs. So their amigo is an amigo lahotzi. It might still be a problem. It's not amigo lahotzi. It's not amigo to take money out. But in the case of this gift, once we define the brother who got the gift as the muchzak, as the person in halachic possession of the item, we couldn't take it away from him by virtue of amigo. And not only that, the other way around. If he makes a claim based on amigo now, and we're going to use that to justify his keeping it and to help him keep it, that's not going to be amigo lahotzi either because it was already in his possession. That's amigo lahachazi because amigo to keep it in his possession, and that'll therefore be acceptable. Then Rabbi Berlin writes that he reread the letter. And there's a practical issue here that he wants to point out, that there is some worry that in this case, that the son who got the gift had taken a signed blank promissory note from his father. So there's this word that they use that I'm not sure what it meant in the Russian context, the vexel. And I'm just not sure what it means. I looked it up. I tried to look up. I didn't find it. But it seems to me something like a promissory note. And so he wrote above it whatever he wanted. But later in the response, it becomes clear that the government set the upper value of this note. So maybe he wrote that upper value, and that's what we're worried about. But it's not quite clear what he could have written that would have been so terrible, other than he could have written who the beneficiary was. Like, it made the note his, meaning if the note was already written for a certain value, then he could maybe write a date on it, write himself. But in any case, this is not a halachic issue. It's part of being sure, Rav Chaim Berlin is trying to point out, part of being sure that it's not a forgery is not only that the whole thing isn't a forgery, but that there's no fraud in terms of that this is a promissory note that the father had taken out for some completely other purpose, and the son found it, grabbed it, and wrote his name in as the beneficiary of the one who the father owed the money to. And then you'd have to worry about theft as well, but to the extent that you can verify the original story, even if the original story is the son pressured the father, he's putting him, let's say this is the son who lives in the neighborhood, and the son spends weeks or months saying to the father, I live here, I'm such a nice guy to you, just give me something, I need the money, and this, until the father signed the note and gave it to him, even if it was blank, it's still going to be legally valid because the father did so of his own free will and he didn't connect it to avoiding the inheritance. And now I would say in our time you might want to raise issues of mental competence of the father's being so pressured by the kid, but that would be another, I think, question that would require proof and evidence, not just assumptions. So the last halachic point that Rabbi Chaim Berlin raises is the question of signing something ahead of time. When it comes to shtarot, to documents of sales or of loans, so the achronim talk about whether you can sign it and then only afterwards write above it the details of the transaction. There's a whole problem with how we write shtarot and whether that will lead to financial consequences for people outside of this transaction, and you have to worry about all those things. But Rav Chaim Berlin says the problem isn't relevant here, because the amount of the note is set by the government. It's not quite a promissory note. It's some kind of a denominationed note set by the government. All that you write is the identity. It would be more like maybe not a bearer bond, but a traveler's check, let's say. You buy a traveler's check for a certain amount, and then you write the name of the recipient. And the question is, did the son put in his name on traveler's checks? I'm just making that up, but on those kinds of things that the father had owned. In that situation, so Rav Chaim Berlin is confident that even if the father signed it first and filled in the details later, that's fine because you're not creating any new obligations. The amount of money in the obligation has already been set and the value of it is already set, and therefore he thinks it's okay. So sum total. It's possible that this son put undue pressure on his father. It's possible, and we do know of situations where gifts that are made for improper purposes, such as specifically to circumvent other people's rights, the only question relevant is whether or not the father explicitly meant to do it for that purpose, and he said so, gave some evidence to do it for that purpose, or there was fraud or forgery, and all those are largely factual questions rather than halachic ones, because halachically, to the extent the father did it to avoid giving the inheritance to the children, there would be a problem. It would be similar to the avoidance of a debt. To the extent the father didn't do it for that purpose, then there's no issue, even if it's very upsetting to the other sons. And that is a responsible day for the first day of Rosh Chodesh Kislev, Rabbi Chaim Berlin from Shut Nishmat Chaim, Responsum 169. Thank you to the OU, to Rabbi Jacob Bromwich, David Hochhauser. Thank you for joining me. We'll see you next time.